Just before you listen to today's episode, this is a quick message to remind you that if you like what you hear, you can help support History Hack, which is run entirely by volunteers using our Patreon account. There are links on all of our episodes. Or if a subscription is not your thing, you can also now drop us a line on Ko-fi, which is just the equivalent of buying us a drink. So if you hear an episode, you like it, and you want to chip in just once, then you can do that too. Thank you. Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. We're very excited today because we're doing something that, frankly, the two hosts on this one don't know that much about. I have Kate with me today, and for reasons that will become apparent very quickly, because we all know where Kate is based. Kate, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
Who have we got with us?
We've got Jonathan Whitehead with us today, who's an historian who's lived and worked in Spain for decades. His book, Franco, The History to the Defeat, was published in 2018 and was an account of life under the dictatorship. We're here today to talk about his latest work, which looks at Spanish Republicans in the Second World War.
Hello, Jonathan.
Hello.
This is going to be very good. This is something, like, as I said, that neither of us really know anything about. So we are excited to learn from you. The story of what happened to the Republicans after their defeat by Franco is not well known. Why is it important?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that, of course, because the Second World War is important, so all things related to that are important. But specifically, the story of the Republicans is that for so long, they were excluded from history. They were excluded from history books. There was no mention of the Spanish Republicans in any history book or in any review of what happened. And they made an important contribution. And as we'll talk later, one particular person made a huge contribution to the Allied war effort. I've dragged my family all around the world to sort of remote places like Hiroshima and Pearl Harbor and Auschwitz to see all these places related to the Second World War. And everywhere you go around, like Moscow, the underground stations in Moscow, there are all these tributes to the people who served, the people who died, the people who suffered in the Second World War, but no mention of the Republicans. And I just thought, enough, they deserve to be remembered and celebrated.
Okay, so let's start with a really quick look at the layman. At who the Republicans are. As regular listeners are familiar with, I live in Spain, but even I'm not really sure. So who are the Republicans? What do they stand for during the Spanish Civil War?
Okay, I'll try to be brief, but this is such a big question. Essentially, the Second Republic was proclaimed in 1931. The king, Alfonso XIII, who in fact, and his English wife, Victoria Eugenia, left Spain because they realized that the monarchy was deeply unpopular. And rather than abdicate, they decided they were just going to exile. At this point, the Second Republic was proclaimed. Large numbers of people, particularly on the left, assumed that this was the end to all their problems. The Second Republic was going to convert Spain into a modern, dynamic, progressive country. Okay. First of all, there was a left-wing government, and there was a lot of social reform, but the next elections were won by the conservatives, who undid all the reforms. So we come to 1936. There's a general election at the beginning of 1936, which is won by the Popular Front, which is an electoral coalition of the centre-left parties, the Republican parties, the Socialist Party, and the Communist Party. They win the elections, and a government is formed by the centre-left Republican parties with the parliamentary support of the Socialists and the Communists, who aren't actually in the government, but support it. The summer of 1936, a group of disaffected army generals, with the support of the church, the industrialists, the big landowners, and a minuscule fascist party, which is called the Falange, which had won no seats in the election, they decided that they were not going to put up with this and organized a coup d'etat. The coup d'etat failed essentially because the people of the big cities rebelled against it. And these army generals failed to take cities like Madrid, Barcelona, Valencia, and so on. But rather than stand down, these generals who'd seen that the coup d'etat had failed carried on, and the country simply descended into a civil war. a civil war between those loyal to the Republic, loyal to the legitimately democratically elected government in Madrid, and those that supported the disaffected generals. So the Republicans are essentially the people who were loyal to the regime, to the official democratic legitimate regime. Unfortunately, now to cut it short, because otherwise
yeah.
they lost, as we know, yeah. history knows, General Franco won with the support of Hitler and Mussolini, and the Republicans lost. Therefore, they were the defeated, the vanquished.
Let's start with the fall of Barcelona for the purposes of your story then, at the beginning of 1939. What did that mean for Spain and for the Spanish Republicans? Where do they go?
Yeah, by this point, Barcelona had become the centre of government because the centre yeah. the government had moved from Madrid to Valencia and finally to Barcelona. So it was, in that sense, the centre of the government of the Republic. The Republican army had been destroyed at the Battle of the Ebro, which is the battle preceding the offensive in Catalonia. The Franco's armies just walked straight through Catalonia, took Barcelona, and that really was the end. Although the war carried on for a couple of months, really everybody saw then the writing was on the wall and it was all over. The Republican masses in Catalonia then fled, and they fled northwards, obviously, to the Pyrenees, hoping to find refuge in France. And that's where the story really begins, because nearly 500,000 refugees left Catalonia and crossed the Pyrenees into France in January, February of 1939. It was one of the great humanitarian catastrophes, crises of that, of the first half of the 20th century.
So what does life look like for Spanish refugees in France? They don't stay very long, a lot of them, do they?
No, it really doesn't look very good. I am very critical of the French authorities, but to be fair to the French, I mean, you suddenly get 500,000 refugees. At that stage of the 20th century, it was difficult to cope. So they improvised concentration camps. And when I say concentration camps, I mean, these camps didn't exist. They hoarded these people onto the beaches, particularly at Argel-sur-Mer, just across the border into France, 80,000 of them there, and just put barbed wire around them. Wow. That was what the concentration camp was. No buildings, nothing else. So of course, you have to remember, this was midwinter. So these people were left on the beach, no water, no sanitary facilities, virtually no food, and it was freezing cold. So they had to dig holes in the sand to protect themselves from the fact that it was just absolutely unbelievable. Then there were more camps were open because obviously that more and more people arriving, but in the same conditions, on beaches or improvised, whatever, but absolute misery. They the French authorities immediately offered to repatriate those people who would be willing to go back. And given the panorama in France, 150,000 immediately returned to Spain. They simply assumed that life could not be that bad in Spain.
By June 1940, the German army has reached the Pyrenees, hasn't it? So on the other side of the mountains sits Franco, Hitler's mate. This is deeply troubling, isn't it? Was Spain ever close to joining the war? Hitler expects it of them, doesn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a question of gratitude, as I said before. Without Hitler and Mussolini, Franco would not have won. Well, no, I shouldn't say that. I don't think that he would have won the Civil War without the help of Franco, without the help of Hitler and Mussolini. So he owes them this great debt. But he also has very close ideological affinities. He sees himself perhaps not quite an out-and-out fascist, but very extreme right authoritarian. And as well, he's tempted, he wants to recreate the Spanish Empire in North Africa. He thinks that if he joins with the Germans and the Italians, he'll be given compensation in North Africa. And of course, he also wants to win back Gibraltar. Gibraltar cannot be forgotten. He also feels that if he sides with the Germans, they will help him recover. So he's very close to it. On the other hand, there are things that worry him. He has this iconic meeting with Hitler in the French town of Endaya in Spanish, on the border between France and Spain, where they discuss Spain joining the war effort. And both men are extremely frustrated, Hitler and Franco, because neither can actually get guarantees from the other of what they want. And that's really the crunch point where Franco decides that he's not going to join the war effort, but he is very, very tempted. If the Germans had offered him what he wanted, then he would have declared war on Britain.
And yet the Spanish Republicans elected to fight. How did that come about, and why? Surely that's renewing the fight against fascism.
Yeah. I don't think the Republicans, at this stage, a lot of the Republicans that were still in France had left the camps, okay? And they had joined, they were working in industry, they were working in agriculture. They were filling the gap of young Frenchmen who'd been conscripted because of the approach of the Second World War. Okay, and they also joined special labor groups that were employed to help with the preparations. There were special regiments set up by the French to supplement the French army and so on. So the Spanish people were beginning to spread out. They'd spread out from the camps. Okay, for them, This the Second World War wasn't a new war. It was simply an extension of what they'd been fighting before. They didn't see themselves as having a choice. It was just the natural thing. In fact, they didn't refer to the Spanish Civil War as the Spanish Civil War. They referred to it as the Spanish War, the first battle, the first fight against international fascism. It's interesting, the French, actually, I'm jumping the gun. I'm sorry, I'm going too far.
It's getting overexcited. It's okay, we'll get there. Okay, let's have a look at some of the various experiences then of Spanish Republicans during the Second World War. Let's start with Dunkirk, because there are Spaniards evacuated from Dunkirk and also who serve in Norway as well. So this is the early part of the war. How does that come about?
Yeah, so some of the Spanish Republicans who had actually joined the French army, the French Foreign Legion, these work groups that were acting as supplementary sappers and so on for the French army, followed the French army to Dunkirk, and therefore were evacuated with them. Not very many, to be fair. But at the same time, a lot of French Republicans still in the south of France had joined the French Foreign Legion as a way out of the camp. There's just so many things that I have to say. Sorry. You have to remember as well that these people were battle-hardened veterans. They were really, really good soldiers. They'd been fighting for 3 years in very difficult conditions, and they were very, very good soldiers. So they were welcomed with open arms by the French Foreign Legion. When the British and the French took the decision to occupy Norway, the French decided that they would use a division of the French Foreign Legion in the attack on Norway. And that's really how the Spanish Republicans ended up in Norway. They were transferred as part of the Foreign Legion into France, from North Africa into France, and then to Britain. And then from Britain, they went to Norway. And they fought along with the British, and very successfully, as I say, brilliant soldiers, recklessly courageous. But then, as we know, the operations in Norway were cancelled. They were cancelled because the Germans at this point were ready to attack France. And so the British and the French decided the time had come to pull out of Norway and to concentrate their efforts in France, in the Battle of France.
Okay, and then enter Ian Fleming of James Bond fame and Operation Goldeneye. What's that? What's that about?
GoldenEye is if you like an umbrella operation. It's so we really have to now fast forward.
Yeah.
So the Germans occupy France. They divide France into the two zones. The southern zone being the Vichy, where the Vichy regime was, and a large number of the Republicans were there in the south of Spain, south of France, in the Vichy area. But of course, at this point, the Germans had reached the Pyrenees. The Germans were there. And so the British intelligence forces panicked because they were aware. Maybe today we're not quite so aware of just how important Gibraltar was.
Mm.
But in the Second World War, Gibraltar was absolutely crucial. It was the gateway to the Mediterranean. And Britain was dependent upon the supply bases at Malta, at the Suez Canal, and so on. So Gibraltar was absolutely fundamental. And so when Hitler reached the Pyrenees, the British intelligence services panicked. If he took Gibraltar, that would be a critical setback for the British. So they, Ian Fleming of the Naval Intelligence Service came up with this plan, this umbrella plan to organize the intelligence and sabotage on the Iberian Peninsula if the Germans crossed the Pyrenees and went for Gibraltar.
I think Gibraltar still is hugely important. I think it's not as, perhaps the importance isn't as well known, but I think it's still, politically and physically very important.
What's brilliant as well is that you think about operations that do go ahead in World War II. And for every operation that does go ahead, there's like myriad other contingencies that don't. There are lots of other contingencies involving Spain and the Spanish, aren't there? Operation Relator, which is more commonly known as Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves. Why is this?
I don't know why it's called Ali Baba. I'm sorry. I did spend some time once in Kew Gardens. No, sorry, not Kew Gardens. In Kew, the National Archives.
Yeah.
Trying to work out where they came up with all these names. There are extraordinary names, and I'm afraid I had no luck at all. I don't know why it's called that. But there were, under the umbrella of Operation GoldenEye, there were several plans. One was Operation Sconce, which was what the British would do if Hitler invaded Spain with the support of Franco. Okay, in other words, if Franco opened the frontier and let the Germans through. And the other one was Operation Sprinkler, which is exactly the same, except if Franco resisted the German invasion. So you've got these two parallel plans. One if the Germans and the Spanish collaborate, and one if they don't. Okay, and part of this as well was Operation Relator, which is where the British plan to drop a number of elite officers into Spain, who would then disperse throughout the Iberian Peninsula and organize resistance in the case of a German invasion. Okay.
Mm.
There's another even more exotic operation that never happened, which is Operation Tracer, which was the authorities in Gibraltar decided that they were in grave danger. The Germans were rampant throughout Europe. Who was going to stop them? And so they assumed that there was a very strong likelihood that the Germans would take Gibraltar. So they came up with Operation Tracer, where they were going to bury a group of observers in a cave at the top of the Rock of Gibraltar, close with supplies, obviously water and food and so on, close the entrance to the cave and leave them there. And they were going to stay there for as long as they could possibly survive, watching the Straits of Gibraltar and sending intelligence back to Britain. Those caves are there. You can visit them. Have you been, Kate?
I have, yeah. There are actually, just an aside fact, there are actually more miles of road inside the Rock of Gibraltar than outside it. There are quite a lot of caves that you can visit and an awful lot more that you can't. Yeah, there's a huge network. Yeah.
So it's fascinating, but as you said, Alex, it was one of these plans that never came about. There's one other plan which I should mention, and that is the Knights of St. George, which is a little bit more famous. It had a little bit of coverage in the British press recently, which was Churchill's plan to bribe Spanish generals. So A lot of money was sent to various members of the Spanish military, diplomatic corps and so on, to bribe them to argue with Franco on the advantages of staying neutral and of resisting any approach by Hitler to invade Spain and therefore grab Gibraltar. Cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
We don't know how effective it was. Simply because history shows us that the Germans didn't invade and didn't take Gibraltar. So how effective that was, we don't know.
It's nuts, isn't it? In desperation, anything that would tip it in your favour.
Absolutely. No, you're right. That was Churchill's attitude.
Mm.
Churchill was just desperate. He said victory at all costs, at any cost, I think, or at all costs, anything. But to answer your first question, so a previous question, Franco really was very close to joining the war. The British were panicking about it because of the importance of Gibraltar. And it was very much on the edge, very much on the edge.
Why is Barbarossa a win for Franco?
Barbarossa, the invasion of the Soviet Union in June 1941, solved a big problem for Franco. As we mentioned before, the Germans expected some gratitude from him, and they didn't. And Franco was, I have a very bad opinion of Franco, but he was very canny. He was not a stupid man. He was worried. He wasn't quite so sure that the Germans were going to win. And he was very worried by the Battle of Britain. He felt that that was more decisive than the Germans had actually realized. And he was also worried about the intervention of the United States at some point in the future. So he was very, very wary of declaring war on Britain. However much he wanted to, until he got guarantees, he was very worried. So when the Germans attacked the Soviet Union, this gave him a new option, because he felt now there were two wars. There was the war in the West and the war on communism. And of course, he was the greatest anti-communist in Europe. And this gave him an opening. This gave him a chance to show his gratitude to Hitler by supporting him on the front, on the Eastern Front against Russia. He was also under some pressure at home in Spain, because there were people in Spain as well who expected him to show a bit more gratitude to Hitler and were more pro-Nazi than he was. So this was an option to show them as well that his solidarity with the Germans.
He does, as you say, he commits troops to the Eastern Front. What is the DEV and what do they get up to?
Yeah, the important thing to say here is that they were volunteers.
Right.
But you're never quite sure in a dictatorship like Franco's dictatorship.
Absolutely, yeah.
Volunteers and who aren't volunteers, but officially they were volunteers. It is the División Española de Voluntarios, the Spanish Volunteer Division. And immediately after Barbarossa, the dictatorship makes a call for people to volunteer to go and fight with the Germans. And there's a big answer, 18,000 people enroll immediately to go and fight. So there's quite a response to it. And off they go. They're known as the Blue Division because they were given the uniform in Spain, which involved a blue shirt. And the blue shirt was the symbol of the fascist party. Like in, there was the black shirts and the brown shirts and so on. Well, in Spain, it was the blue shirts. So they were equipped with these blue shirts and therefore they became known as the Blue Division. So they went they got to Bavaria, they were trained. They took an oath of allegiance to Hitler. They were given Wehrmacht uniforms and they were sent to Moscow. They were going to liberate Moscow. On the way to Moscow, they were diverted. They were sent to Leningrad, and they spent the war participating in the siege of Leningrad. That was where the Division Azul was based. Okay, the siege of Leningrad lasted 900 days. The population of Leningrad, of course, is now St. Petersburg. Leningrad, the siege lasted 900 days. The people were reduced to starvation, cold, disease. But they resisted. The División Azul, again, this is the second time I've said it, but they fought with reckless courage. They were just not frightened of death. They went, the Germans couldn't believe it. Hitler, in a conversation, said that he was desperate about the Spanish because they were dirty, untidy, always late, and couldn't even clean their own rifles, but were brilliant soldiers. And that the SS fighting in the siege said that they always wanted their flanks covered by the Division Azul, because here were people that they could trust to fight to the last man. So that was the Division Azul.
So the anecdotes that you've got in about the Spaniards in the Soviet army and the Spanish airmen too, haven't you? Will you tell us about those?
Yeah, sure. So there were two different groups of Republicans in the Soviet Union. There were those that had gone to the Soviet Union for training. So they in the military schools, in the Air Force schools and so on. And there were all the academies rather than schools. Sorry. And there were also the Communist Party leadership that had left Spain into France across the Pyrenees at the time of the defeat, who were evacuated then to the Soviet Union. So there were these two groups. The pilots who were doing their training in the academy there were involved in one particular anecdote, which is worthy of note, and that is that when Stalin was invited to attend the conference at Tehran with Churchill and Roosevelt, he was terrified of flying. So they took him as close as they possibly could within the Soviet Union to Baku, which is now in
Azerbaijan.
Thank you very much. They got him as close to Tehran as possible, and then they flew him from there to Tehran. And it was there was a group of Spanish pilots that accompanied him to Tehran. Okay, and when they arrived in Tehran, he was extremely grateful and he wanted to thank them to show his gratitude. So he went over to where these pilots had landed and they were just standing around, and he gave his thanks and said, "But why are you wearing your pajamas?" There is another story which says, "Not pajamas, your underwear." But it's the same point. In other words, these people were, you know, in such poor conditions, they didn't even have a uniform. And there they were flying the guards so immediately Stalin ordered that these people should be given a proper uniform at the very least.
Person with the worst Spanish in the room has landed this. Brilliant. Who was Juan Pujol Garcia and why is he important?
He was a Catalan. He was during the Spanish Civil War, he was conscripted into the Republican Army. He didn't like it, so he deserted, crossed over into the nationalist area, joined the nationalist army, but claimed that he, throughout the Civil War, had never shot a gun in anger.
Right.
The Civil War was over. He decided, rather bizarrely, that he didn't like Franco. And he certainly didn't like Hitler and Mussolini, but he was also anti-communist. So he was in a very difficult situation. But he decided, I'm sorry, I'm accelerating now because I appreciate that it's so. He decided the thing that he could do to help the Allied campaign would be to become a spy. So he approached the British Embassy in Madrid and offered his services as a spy. They said no, weren't interested, didn't care.
Right.
Okay. So then instead, he thought, I'll approach the Germans. So he approached the German embassy in Madrid and offered his services to them. His plan was always to serve the Allies, but he thought that if he could integrate the German intelligence services, he could help the Allies by passing secrets to them. The Germans were far more interested in him and decided to use him and gave him a code name, Arabelle. He told the Germans that he was going to go to Britain and he would serve in Britain as an agent and send them intelligence. And so they gave him all the things that he needed, including money, and off he went. In fact, he got as far as Portugal. And from Lisbon, he contacted his German agents in Madrid and said, I'm in Britain. I will start sending you intelligence immediately, as he did. This now begins to sound like a Graham Greene novel, because what he did was simply invent intelligence to send to the Germans. Okay? So then he approaches the British Embassy in Lisbon and tells them what he's done and says, now will you use me? No, they say, still not interested. To be fair to them, they've made major breakthroughs in code breaking and so on at Bletchley Park. And they're making so much progress that they're very worried about this character who might be working for the Germans. And, you know, they didn't want any leaks. So they were particularly cautious. Anyway, eventually, it turns out that the Americans and various Britons realize that this man really could be quite useful. So they fly him out of Portugal to Gibraltar and from Gibraltar to London. He's given a handler, Thomas Harris. He's put in touch with the 20 committee, the Double Cross Committee, and it's decided to use him as a double agent. He sets up this completely fictitious network of spies in Britain, or something like 25 spies, who've also got their own network. So there's this vast network across Britain, completely fictitious, which the British then use to feed the Germans disinformation. Okay, so this goes on. They just, the Germans are so impressed by this high level intelligence that, Pujol has been named by the British intelligence services Garbo, because they thought he was such a brilliant actor, he deserved the name of the most famous actress in the world. So they called him Garbo. Okay, and they fed all this extraordinary disinformation to the Germans. The most important, and this is why I think that he was one of the most crucial characters of the Second World War, his role in D-Day. Because again, in the modern world, we tend to think that there was something inevitable about the Allied victory after D-Day. In 1944, there was nothing inevitable about it. It was touch and go. The British and the Americans were really not sure whether they would be able to hold a beachhead in Normandy, particularly if the Germans sent reinforcements quickly to Normandy. So they came up with another operation, Operation Fortitude, which was to convince the Germans that the attack on Normandy was a feint. The real attack was going to come at Calais, which of course was logical because it was so much closer to Britain, and of course closer to Berlin. Once they got there, they'd be that much closer to Berlin as well. So this operation was designed to persuade Hitler and the Germans that D-Day was just a feint. And key to this was Pujol, Garbo, who sent all these messages to Berlin, telling them not to believe anything about D-Day, that it was Patton who was going to lead the main invasion force. Patton had this huge army in Kent. They were ready to attack, that under in no circumstances should the Germans send reinforcements to Normandy. They would just be sucked in, et cetera, et cetera. And on it went. And it worked. After D-Day, it was a long time after D-Day before the Germans were actually realized what was happening and sent reinforcements. And by that point, it was too late. The Allies had a beachhead in Normandy. And we don't know how many lives that deception saved.
Yeah.
It's impossible to calculate. But I think I would go further. This is a personal feeling. I wonder if the very success of the Normandy landings depended on Operation Fortitude, not just saving lives, but I feel that if the Germans had reacted quickly and had sent their elite SS forces to Normandy, they could have driven the Allies back.
That's a bad thing about, does it?
So this is why, for me, Pujol Garbo is one of the most crucial figures of the whole of the Second World War. He's also one of the few people who was decorated by the Germans, who gave him the Iron Cross, and the British, who gave him an MBE for his services.
Suckers.
even after D-Day, the Germans kept on believing him. It's quite extraordinary.
Brilliant, isn't it?
Brilliant.
They kept using him because they used him because at this point they were sending the V-1s and the V-2 bombs over. It was difficult for them to calibrate, to work out exactly where they were landing. So they asked him for intelligence, and he gave them, of course, completely false intelligence. So they readjusted, they recalibrated their V-1s on the basis of his false information. So they got it even more wrong So these V1s and V2s were coming down in countryside rather than on the big cities. So this guy was big.
What is the deuxième? Why does it factor into our story? A French division, why does that factor into our story?
Okay. I really am going to cut this short now because it starts in Africa. Okay. Very quickly, at the beginning of the war, de Gaulle sets up the Free French. He sends an army under General Leclerc, a very famous French general, to French Equatorial Africa. They fight their way up through Africa, liberating Chad, Libya. They join up with the Eighth Army, and they finish in North Africa with the Eighth Army. Then they are transferred with the French to Britain. The forces that had been fighting with Leclerc were now formed into what was called the deuxième brigade, the second brigade, which was the great French army in Britain. Okay, I'm going too quickly. So they were ready, they were prepared to join the Allied invasion of Normandy. They were equipped by the American army, so they were given Sherman tanks, and they were given these brilliant vehicles, which were called half tracks, which were wheels at the front and caterpillar tracks at the back. They were really brilliant military vehicles because you steered with the wheels at the front, but the tracks at the back gave you greater traction and so on. And they were ready in 1944. The British and the Americans were reluctant to allow the French. When I say French, of course, now I'm referring as well to the Spanish Republicans, who are an integral part of the French army. The British and the Americans were loath to let them participate in D-Day. So the French forces did not actually arrive in France until August. Okay. Their priority, of course, is the liberation of France. And that begins with the liberation of Paris. The British, their priority is to destroy the V1 and V2 missile sites on the north coast. And the priority of the Americans, Eisenhower, the commander, was to get to Berlin as quickly as possible. So they weren't interested in Paris. De Gaulle negotiated and said, no, we must take Paris. And Eisenhower very generously said that he would allow a French force, French regiments, to liberate Paris. It was a very generous thing for him to do. So that's how it happened. So the deuxième blindé, the second armored division, heads directly for Paris. Okay. So the end of August, they're ready. The French resistance rise up in the center of Paris. And the deuxième blindé, they think that it's urgent for them to get into France as quickly as possible to make contact with the resistance. So they send a company. And I think it's random. I don't know. I can't believe it was anything else. They chose the ninth company, La Nueve, which was made up almost entirely of Spanish Republicans. The commander, Captain Dron, was French, but the troops were Spanish. And so they were ordered as quickly as possible to get into the center of Paris and make contact with the resistance. So the first Allied troops to get into Paris, almost in the sense of to liberate Paris, were Spanish Republicans, who drove through with these half tracks, waving Spanish Republican flags, singing Spanish songs, etc. And they made the first contact with the French resistance, which is extraordinary.
It really is. I think we should just quickly pay tribute to Rafael Gomez Nieto too, because he comes up in your book, and that was quite something else. Who was he, and what did he say about his role in all of this?
Yeah, he's a symbol, because he was the last surviving member of this company, La Nueve, the ninth company, and he died last year in Strasbourg, 2020, of COVID, coronavirus.
Bloody COVID.
Yeah, well, he was, you know, inevitable. He was in a residence And so it was very sad. But he is a symbol. He's everything. He fought in the Spanish Civil War. He fought at this vital battle of the Ebro. He crossed the Pyrenees with the refugees when they left in 39. He was incarcerated on the beach in Argel-sur-Mer. He escaped. He went to North Africa with his father. He joined the French forces in North Africa. He was transferred to Britain with the Zeeën Blindé. He landed on the beaches as part of Patton's army, and he was one of the first, literally the first, into the center of Paris to make contact with the resistance. Having done that with the rest of his company, he then continued, because the war hadn't finished. So he ended his war in Berchtesgaden, in Hitler's eagle's nest. They got that far before the Germans surrendered. So he was actually in Hitler's eagle nest when the surrender was announced. And he appropriated a tea set and a chess set, which he had until his dying day, which he kept very proudly with him. For all that, is this man a hero? I mean, the great fighting fascism for 9 years.
Yeah.
He was asked by a journalist towards the end of his life to define war. And he said, people kill, people die, it's horrible. That's all he had to say about war. No glory, no honor, no, just.
He sounds like quite the man. That's why I wanted to mention him.
Yeah. So finally, let's talk about the Battle of Val d'Arrane. It's the culmination of Republican involvement in the Second World War, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So the Spanish had been, the Spanish Republicans had been very active in the French resistance. In fact, I mean, more than anything else, they almost initiated it, because at the beginning, the French were quite ambiguous about this, because they were in the south of France, because they weren't sure about Pétain and the Vichy regime. They weren't absolutely sure whether this was that bad, whereas the Spanish knew it was bad. The Spanish just wanted to fight fascism wherever it was, whoever was, they just wanted to fight. But so the French resistance developed, of course. These forces were fundamental in liberating Southwest France, because the Allies never reached Southwest France. So there were no Allied armies there. So it was the resistance with the French Republicans who liberated Southwest France. So towards the autumn of 1944, there are 10,000 heavily armed, by now incredibly battle-hardened Republicans, ready to take on Franco. Okay? They assumed, rightly or wrongly, that the Allies were going to help them. They thought the Allies had, they'd helped the Allies. They simply assumed that the Allies would liberate Spain. They defeated Hitler, they defeated Mussolini. Roosevelt had made a promise that the Americans would leave not a vestige of fascism, not a vestige of dictatorships in Europe. So there it was, Madrid, Franco, fascist dictatorship. But they decided that they needed to nudge the Allies. So what they thought they would do was to establish a bridgehead across the Pyrenees. So they chose a place called the Val d'Arran. If you ever want a holiday and you like mountains, I can strongly recommend the Valley of Arran, the Val d'Arran. It is one of the most beautiful places in Spain, right at the top of the Pyrenees. It's very popular now for skiing resorts and so on. But the advantage of this place was that it was very easy to access it from France, but very difficult to access it from Catalonia and Spain. So the idea was that they would invade, that the Republicans would invade the Val d'Arran, take it, and hold it, and almost suck in the Allied armies. And they also felt that the population, when the population in Catalonia realized what was happening, they would rise up and support this, this liberation movement. So in October 1944, they sent in a first force of 4,000 Republicans, by this point, they were calling themselves the Mackie. Of course, they were also called guerrilla. It's one of the ironic things that guerrilla, of course, is a Spanish word. They didn't actually call themselves guerrillas as much as they called themselves Mackie. It's not something I've ever quite understood. But anyway, 4,000 Mackie crossed the border into the Val d'Aran. And they set up their headquarters in a little village called Boursault, and they raised the Republican flag, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. They failed to take the capital, Biella, and they failed to take the one pass that makes the Val d'Aran accessible from the rest of Spain. Those two failures are absolutely crucial. Their plan was that within weeks it would start to snow, and there is no way that the Franco's armies would be able to attack the valley because of the conditions throughout the winter, and therefore it would be relatively easy to hold this bridgehead. But they failed to take the pass, and therefore Franco's army began to mass, we don't know how many, but you know, many more than the Maquis, ready to counterattack. So after about 7 or 8 days, they decided to withdraw. The people had not risen up to support them. The officers found that their troops were reluctant to open fire on Spanish troops because they felt that they were brothers. It was difficult for them to start shooting people who had been conscripted into this army and might well have been Republican sympathizers anyway. So they happily shot at the Guardia Civil and the police. They didn't have any problem doing that because after all, these were professionals who'd chosen it. But the long and the short of it, they failed to take the capital. They failed to take the main Bonaigua Pass, and Franco's army is about to counterattack. So they withdraw, and that's it. That is the end of the Battle of Aran.
And then we've got another, 30 odd years of fascism in Spain?
Yeah, that's a huge story.
Yeah, which you have also done a book about. We should get you back to talk about that, because, as you say, it's immense. Jonathan, thank you so much for coming on to talk to us about your new book. Remind everybody of the title.
The title is the Spanish Republicans and the Second World War.
It's brilliant. It's out now, and it is available on the History Hack bookshops. You can jump on there and buy it. It's fantastic. I think the best history is the one that fills gaps you didn't even know existed. I don't know about you, Kate, but this one absolutely qualifies.
Yeah, definitely. I've learned loads today, and there's loads that I'm going to go away and try to find out more about, definitely. Yeah, thank you very much.
I do apologise for being so accelerated. It's just so much that I wanted
to say. Yeah, it's fine. But people will love it. We'll have to have you back to talk some more.
Okay, very nice to talk to you.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.